They get all night.
Is there black lips? There is.
Oh, yeah, there's definitely black lips.
Okay.
Good morning. It is March the 4th. And we are here meeting with the Oregon Department of Education folks. Deputy Superintendent Saxon, you're back on.
Mr. Chair, just as a procedure note, the presentation is on yesterday's date to find it. And something I didn't mention yesterday, there are a couple other handouts or things on the or on yesterday's meeting materials, and one of them is sort of the supplementary materials of ODE, and you'll find a lot more detail on KPMs and various reports that the co-chairs want to be as part of the presentation. They won't go through it specifically, but it's there as the as resources for you, as well as a document called ODE's Governor's Budget. And this is an ungainly document, very large. It is essentially the old budget binders that you used to see up until last session. So that is there as your resource, and if you really want to dive into the details, that's where you go.
And we're on page 27.
Co-chairs Compham and Rowe, members of the committee, for the record, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction Rob Saxton. It's great to see everybody this morning. We had some questions yesterday, and have we already handed these out? I believe that we've handed these out and that you're at your place, and their responses to the questions that we did get, I think they're, you'll find them to be fairly thorough answers. And I could take a brief moment and pop through them at your pleasure. The first one has to do with the Oregon School for the Blind students, where they are now, what services they're receiving, and there's a chart below that shows where that sits in the 14-15 school year. Very few former Oregon School for the Blind students still in the school system, all 16 to 20 years old. And you can see that six are in public school setting. There are seven students remaining, one's not enrolled in school.
Mr. Chair.
And there's some information there as well.
Senator Huffman.
Thank you. Rob, do we still pay for, allow, have an agreement with the Washington School of the Blind in Vancouver to send? Because I was thinking after we closed the school, one or two of them were allowed to go over there. So I was just curious if that was an ongoing thing that we allow.
Co-chairs Compton, Monroe, Representative Huffman, I don't know the answer, but I think that Cindy Hunt does. If you would allow her to respond, that would be great.
Uh-oh, help coming.
Sorry, Cindy.
No, it's okay. Cindy Hunt, Oregon Department of Education. You're correct, Representative Huffman. When the school first closed, we had an agreement with the Washington School for the Blind, and I believe we placed two of Oregon students up there. Currently, though, of the students that are left, none of those are placed at the School for the Blind. So while we could reinstitute the agreement, so to speak, at this time we don't have need of it.
Follow up?
Go ahead.
So we do have that, and we could make the allowance if a student wanted to, we could work out the agreement.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Senator Roblin.
Thank you. Also to Cindy, do you know most of the people who were at the school had multiple indicators. They were multiply handicapped in different ways. And so a number of them also went to the one that we still do have, which is school for the, we do school for the blind deaf. School for the Deaf. So are there a number of those that are still at the School for the Deaf who were from the original
right.
school?
Chair Compton, Senator Roblin, I believe that based on this information is that there's still only, you know, seven that are left,
okay.
and none of those are at the School for the Deaf right now. But you are correct in your recollection that a couple of them, when the school closed, did go to the School for the Deaf, but there aren't any there now from the former School for the Blind.
Right. Thank you.
Okay. Additional questions on this item? Okay, why don't you go ahead?
Thank you. On the second question was about our parents and statewide notified about statewide assessment or are they required to? And the technical answer to that is no. We provide lots of information for school districts to send to parents, but there is no expectation that's written in statute or rule someplace that says, and you need to notify parents. I think part of that is because we've had such a big testing window open that for so long that really locally we've relied on people to, on districts to make that notice and have it be reasonable. Now that we have a much tighter window, that might be something that we would want to consider. Number three is, which bill provided for the establishment of the chief education officer? And it was Senate Bill 909. And then also in Senate Bill 1581, gives the chief education officer control to, or direct control to heads of agencies for the purpose of creating a P-20 system. So there was a couple of references there. And then in number four, provide a list of vacant positions. We've provided that list of vacant positions. You can see this. This is from December, and we go over these quarterly at the department. Probably the most interesting thing to me on this list is the there are two different things. PF, just so you know, on the second farthest left column means permanent full-time. PP means permanent part-time. And LP means limited part-time. And then there's a reason narrative for why the position is open, and you'll see things like abolishing vacant position, in recruitment process, held vacant due to shortfall of federal grant, reviewing for recruitment needs, no intent on hiring this biennium, using to pay for new positions at other step, that kind of thing. So the rationale is there for each of those. And then lastly, there's an org chart, one of a series, I understand, but it is an org chart that we've been using at the department that's much more conventional in nature.
Okay, questions?
Chair,
Madam Co-Chair.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Monroe. Now, Mr. Saxton, do you have an org chart for 2014, 2013, 2012?
Co-Chair Comp, I don't with me today. I'm sure that we could dig those up from previous iterations.
I would love them.
Okay.
I'm a geek.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Smith Warner.
I would just like to briefly comment on the notification. While I understand that there's not statewide, I can vouch for my kids' school, which is a PTS school, which we have had at least two, if not more, school-wide, invited to all parents, come learn more about Smarter Balanced. There has been much active outreach and information providing, at least that. I'm only one school in one tiny district, but I just wanted to mention that. So.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Saxon, we appreciate your prompt answers to questions that committee members presented to you. This is very helpful. Go ahead.
Thank you, Senator Monroe. I think when I left off, we were on the slide. I was talking a little bit about third grade reading information and showing you the data around implement statewide literacy programs, and that we had a target for June 2015 of having 80% of third graders reading at grade level. And it's not a goal that we believe that we're going to meet, and I showed you that we had that read on our stock take process from the department. And I had talked just a little bit about some of the reasons as to why. I talked a little bit about why the downward trend on the graph, and relayed that I thought much of that was from going from three assessment opportunities to one assessment opportunity. I also think that, quite frankly, we haven't made any progress on helping more third graders, or very, very few third graders, be readers at the end of third grade in aggregate as a state. There are some places where districts have made some moves on that. And one of the points that I think is really important for me to make, that I hope I can make well, is that while out of the last session we received some funding around initiatives that were targeted at helping change this trend, the total dollars that were allocated to this was someplace in the neighborhood of $8 million, and they were split up into about four different initiatives. And one of them was the Oregon Response to Intervention initiative, which I think is a really great initiative, and I can go into that a little bit later about what that is, and I think it does make a difference in the districts that are implementing response to intervention, and it's a good process. Another one was Storytime Anytime, which really targeted early childhood. And that was really about how parents and communities can work with their children to enhance reading, and especially targeted, you know, in the age 3 to age 5 range. And then there probably are some other things that are targeted at this as well. Teacher mentoring, for example, which does make a difference, but takes a little while in order to manifest itself into student outcomes like what we're looking at here. But the point that I really hope to make here is that oftentimes when we take small initiatives, and in the grand scheme, I don't want to diminish $2 million that we've put toward an initiative, but the idea that $2 million is going to move us from 70% of students reading at grade level to 80% of students reading at grade level just isn't real. And what we can do with that is implement something and see if there are gains in the area where we're targeting those resources, and if there are, that it ought to be something we consider replicating or scaling up across the state, and that some of the initiatives that we did at the last session were intended precisely about that. But if you're really going to move a system, you've got to be very aggressive and have something that actually touches the whole system. So one of the things that we did, and I've talked about this a couple times here, is the focus and priority work, where we came alongside schools that were extremely low performing and supported them in planning and implementation of new work at the school, and that we were seeing really good gains from having done that work. We had about $4 million to do that out of the last session. And it's some work that we hope that we can continue, and that we need to continue, actually, to continue to have our waiver. But nonetheless, at the elementary level, we were working closely with about 80 elementary schools on this, again, at a cost of nearly $4 million to the state, and they're using some federal money to support it as well. And in most of those schools, when we look at the data, about 50% of their third-grade students were reading at grade level, just on average. And that if we were unbelievably successful in supporting those schools, and we went from 50% of the third graders reading at grade level and actually got to 90% of the third graders reading at grade level, which would be incredible success. That's not where we're going to get, but we're going to move the dial a lot. We would actually move the state, the 68, 3 percentage points to 71. So we can take that money and we can really make a difference in these 80 elementary schools, but there are 667 elementary schools statewide. And we can move the dial from 50% of students meeting or exceeding to 90% of students meeting or exceeding. And the number on the graph up here goes from 68 to 71. I just really need you to hear that, because it's an important consideration. Because what I'm going to talk about now is what I think it takes in order to actually move the dial, to not just get to 80, but to get to 90%+ of students reading at grade level. And so one of the requests that's in our budget is an age 3 to grade 3 literacy initiative. It doesn't like me. At all. There we go. An age 3 to grade 3 literacy initiative. And in that literacy initiative, the intent would be to impact every learner in the state from age 3 to grade 3 over the next 5 years, with the goal of having 90 to 95% of our third graders reading at grade level. And when we do that in every part of the early learning system, every child care, and in every district, school, and classroom with every student, then we can begin to achieve this goal, but not if we're just going to work more intensively in 80 elementary schools. And so the big picture of this is that we need to support early learning in a different way than we have. We need to connect early learning to the K-12 system, extend time for students who are struggling readers with summer school and after school program through community-based organizations, and we need to offer support for parents in the summer prior to kindergarten, and improve the school age literacy program, including the full day kindergarten. So,
what's the cost of that 3 to 3 in the governor's budget?
The proposal of the governor's budget is $85
million. $85
million? $85
million. And is that lumped in the co-chair's budget, lumped into that $60 million package that they said we could choose what we wanted out of it?
Co-Chair Monroe, yes, my understanding is that it's in the $60 million package. or $60 million that is currently sort of unassigned?
Yeah, there were, I think, $200 million worth of
requests
mm-hmm. that they bunched into that $60 million, and you're saying that this request is $85 million of that, which is more than the total, obviously.
Co-Chairman Rowe, that's correct. And this would be our number one priority as well when we're looking at seeking additional funding.
If we can't fund any of the rest of that package, you'd fund this first.
Co-Chairman Rowe, I don't think I'm at liberty to make that statement here today, but I can tell you that it is our number one priority. And
okay.
I do think that I really believe that this is the game changer. If we're going to pick something in the state of Oregon that's going to move the dial, this is it.
I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just trying to nail you down.
I appreciate that, Senator Monroe, and I'm trying really hard not to be nailed down, in particular because as we're working with Governor Brown around her education priorities, it's important for me to crystallize what that looks like, and hopefully can do that in the next few days so that I can be more concise in the future.
Okay. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rob, is the $85 million formulaic based on student population so that we're not picking winning and losing schools, but everybody's treated the same?
Co-chairs, Compton, Representative Huffman, great question. Yes, pretty much it is formulaic. Everybody would have access to the resources. There are some expectations about what districts would do in order to receive the funding. But it basically goes out to everyone, and it is formulaic. If there is any differentiation in resource, it's around summer school and after school programs based on poverty ratios. And so if I could, I'd love to walk you through what this proposal looks like in a pretty decent way right here so that you have a good understanding of what it is that we're proposing.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And you can tell me that we'll get to this, but when you have age 3 to grade 3, I'm wondering, and 80 whatever million, so if you did a phase in, is that something that you've considered?
Co-Chair Comp, thank you. Yes, actually, when we first proposed this, we put the price tag at $180 million.
And I heard that.
We backed it off
over,
to $85 million, and part of that rationale is because it does require a phase-in. It's not reasonable for us to think that this would pass out of the legislature in July of this year and be signed into law sometime around the end of July, early August, and that we're going to deliver summer school to students this summer,
yeah.
Or that we would even be able to hire up and deliver on this program over the course of the fall. And in fact, to do it right, it takes most of next year to get everything positioned and in place. All the memorandum of understanding, the training, the hiring that it takes to do this, the curriculum if districts choose to purchase curricula and so forth, and then deliver summer school starting late next June, July 2016, and then deliver the program over the 16-17 school year. So to be really clear, the funding for this is a scale up and then 1 year of delivery. And the reason I want to be clear about that is because as we came back in the 19 session, we'd be asking for a double down.
Right.
Yep.
Not sure why there's feedback. But.
I don't know, but Mr. Co-Chair,
go ahead.
I was just wondering if Senator Roblin would be willing to do car washes the length of his district one of these weekends, and then we could provide some more funds.
Yeah, I mean, with lots of help from the committee members to come over to the coast and have a fun time on the coast in a bright, sunny time, look at
the
lighthouses and
right.
And wash cars, yeah, we could probably get something worked out.
Okay.
I could find a city for each one of you.
Count me in.
Okay.
Moving right along.
Co-chairs, at times I've had people say to me, you know, can you, Rob, where did you come up
right.
with 90 or 95%? And the truth of the matter is, this is from experience.
Right.
As a district superintendent in the Tiger Tualatin School District, and this would be my one comment about that district in this reference. During my presentation, I might use it other times, but for this kind of reference, is that When I first got to Tiger 12, about 80% of our third graders read at grade level, and which is a pretty good number, especially when you consider that the demographics in that district virtually mirror the demographics in the state, which is an important consideration as I talk about this, almost identical to the demographics of the state. And that we really intensified our instructional program around literacy and also extended some of the work that we do, not to the degree that this plan even lays out. There are parts of this plan that are much more intensive and much more intentional than what we did in Tiger Tualatin. And we were able to get to 93.5% of our third graders reading at grade level. Mm-hmm. And we were able to close the achievement gap significantly for students of color and students in poverty, because you can't get to 93.5% unless almost everybody's meeting, right? And so it's entirely possible. Now, we changed the benchmark since then. It got a little bit harder, and our numbers, how well our students were doing, didn't really move down, but we went back down a little bit after we changed the benchmark target. As I talk about this initiative, I'm talking about reading at grade level at the end of third grade, which is a little bit devoid of benchmark on the assessments, and so we would need to make sure that we know what we mean by third grade reading. Read at grade level at the end of third grade. That's the intent. And so you can get there, but it takes a very significant effort, and the complete package that I will describe here is what gets you there.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. You may not appreciate this, Rob, but I think it's important for you to relay to us that was not easy nor comfortable, and I think it would probably be wise to hear about some of those challenges.
Yes, Co-Chairs Compton Monroe, Representative Springer, yes, it was not easy or comfortable. There were a couple of times when I thought there were things that we needed to do that probably were going to be uncomfortable enough that I didn't need to be the superintendent anymore, if you take my meaning. And fortunately, you know, when you're able to really coalesce educators in your community and parents and the board and continue to bring people along, and then you start to see the kind of results that we were seeing, you can hang on to it, and then all of a sudden it just becomes breathing, right? It just becomes second nature. It's just what you do, and as the district, it really became just what we did, and people really bought off on it. But some of the changes that it takes are very difficult to implement, and as I talk about this, what you'll find is that we're trying to build in some of the requirements that were the most thorny for us to deal with as a district, saying if you want these resources, here's what you need to do, because they are the catch points that make it difficult to actually implement this in a really robust way. So we've tried to design it to help people get around that by saying, and this is a necessity. The hardest thing to do is to say that we're going to coordinate instructional program in a really effective way. And this was the hardest thing for me. There are other things that this program helps us to overcome, like the handoff from early learning to K-12, and so I'll talk about those things as well. But one of the requirements here would be that teachers across grade level would agree on the methodology that they're going to use to instruct, and both horizontally — when I say horizontally, I mean all kindergarten teachers. A team of kindergarten teachers would say, here's how we're going to teach in the district. And really the way to do that is to bring teachers together and say, how do you want to work on literacy? Let's look at the evidence and the research and convene, and this is what it takes a year to do, and talk about the best way to teach kindergartners to read. And let's make an agreement on that, and we must be committed, if we're going to receive these resources, that all kindergarten teachers are going to use that methodology. The importance of that is, if we're both different kindergarten teachers and I teach one way, I teach whole language and she teaches direct instruction, which is two different ways to teach, and now they go to a first grade teacher, some of her kids and some of my kids all go to the same first grade teacher, and that first grade teacher uses yet another methodology, students are caught in this terrible problem of the teacher who gets them doesn't know how to teach them, because they came from two different methodologies, maybe four if there are four kindergarten teachers. And the first grade teacher believes in doing it a different way and starts to teach a different way, and the kids don't know if they're coming or going. Teacher doesn't know where to start because the kids all showed up differently. And, you know, it just turns into a mess, right? It's what's been comfortable, and it's how maybe I've taught for a long time. But we need an opportunity for teachers to convene and have a discussion about best practice when it comes to instruction around literacy and make agreements that move kids through the system to third grade in a highly coordinated way. So the handoff from kindergarten teachers to first grade teachers should have the same thing. First grade teachers know what they're going to get, so there's a horizontal articulation to the work. And then all first grade teachers are going to teach with a similar methodology that will move those students forward. And so the expectation of this is if you're going to receive these resources, that you will do that work in your district, you'll have agreements about the methodology both horizontally and vertically within the grades, and that you will have an instructional methodology that is common amongst teachers and makes sense to kids.
Representative Springer.
Thank you. Follow up, Mr. Chair. How long did this take? I mean, obviously you're not going to, I would assume this isn't going to turn around in a year, or didn't turn around in a year. So what is it that this body is looking at as far as a time frame that's reasonable to expect results, but not before we can have those results?
Co-chairs Compton and Representative Springer, it took us a year to implement and a year, and then we began delivery. So in the first year is when we did the convening and made discussions about how it was we were going to go about teaching literacy within the district. We got those agreements by mid-year. We made our selection of the materials that were going to be needed to support that about mid-year, and then we began the training component over the course of the spring. So we did staff development for teachers over the course of the spring so they were ready to deliver by the next fall. We also did some staff development over the summer right before students showed up so that it was fresh in everybody's mind. And then we began delivery in the following fall, just as this program is designed to be implemented as possible, I believe, statewide.
Thank you.
Okay. So within this, the very first part of this starts with the early learning. And it gives us an opportunity, these resources give us the opportunity to tie together early learning and K-12 in a different way than we ever have before in the state. We've never had sort of this reason or rationale to do this, and it's difficult to do, and there needs to be something that coalesces early learning and K-12 mm-hmm. and smooths out this handoff between early learning and K-12 differently than we've ever done before. And this is the resource stream that does it. And so one thing that we have right now is we have a set of learning standards in early learning that are different than the learning standards in K-3. And we can fix that by saying, let's make sure that the learning standard expectations in early learning match up with the early learning standards K-3. And in fact, we should have one statewide adoption of learning standards that can be adopted by the Early Learning Council and the State Board of Education that says this is what we want students to know as a 3-year-old, a 4-year-old, a 5-year-old, a 6-year-old, a 7-year-old, and an 8-year-old. And we each have standards, but we've never aligned them. It's another alignment issue. So we use this resource to say we're going to have a statewide aligned standard methodology. And then within hub regions with local districts, we say we also need to align our teaching pedagogy, which is pedagogy is how you're going to go about instructing, which is what I was just talking about, this horizontal and vertical alignment. But you actually do that between early learning and K-3. So that the agreement that we reach about how it is that we're going to teach reading or early literacy is agreed upon in the local community and within the local hub, between hub and community-based organizations and daycare and providers and the K-3 world. And we get that agreement, and then the other agreement that comes along with that is about self-regulation. So there are two really important parts in the early learning world. There are probably many more, but one of them is how you go about teaching literacy, and the other one is about how you go about teaching self-regulation. What's the skills that I have about how I manage myself as a child to be an engaged and capable learner, that I have the behavior set? And that's something that we also need to instruct. And so if you have that expectation, then what we would require is co-professional development between early learning providers and K-3 instructors, same time, same place, and we have the resource to get that done and the personnel that can actually deliver on that, so that we talk about what are the standards, how are we going to teach reading, and how are we going to teach student self-management, behavior, self-regulation, and that the professional development about that is common. We found that with the with one of the grants that we came out with out of the last session around kindergarten innovation, that when we want to provide staff development to early learning providers, they come out in droves. They're hungry for professional development. And we have a rating system now for daycares in the state. And when they do get professional development, their rating goes up. And so they're very hungry, and that we've been able to fill that kind of professional development opportunity for early learning programs with ease, and we believe that we could do that and create this component.
Representative Smith Warner.
Can I pause you right there? And I was just thinking, thank you, Rob, how challenging it must be for you to continue your narrative yet be interrupted by us all the time, so I really appreciate that. I just wanted to stop while you're here to ask about kind of where those methodologies are going to come from, and whether how much it's going to be. Will the state have a set of things that, getting back to the whole state versus local control, and as educators and other people on this panel have said, education does tend to be what goes around comes around, a little flavor of the month. Here's what we did in the 90s, and now we're cycling back to it again. And that is a reality because there are lots of different ways to teach and styles and methods. So I guess what I'm trying to get a sense of is, in this in particular, are there going to be a range of things that the state considers acceptable or preferable or whatever, and each district is going to determine its own? Or is there going to be one methodology or whatever that the state is going to say, this is what you shall do, and implement it in your own ways? I guess that's what I was just trying to get a better sense of.
Co-chairs Compton Monroe, Representative Smith Warner. No, there would not be one statewide methodology. The expectation would be that locally there would be decisions made that are supported by local educators, which is really important. You just can't do it by saying this is what you're going to do. It'll make the wheels fall off, first because people won't do it, and secondly because having somebody do something. Educators hold dear how they teach reading, right? I mean, it is like a sword to die on, right? How I'm going to go about teaching reading, because it's at the heart of what I believe I'm about, and I care deeply about students and their learning. And so you've got to have local buy-in on how it is that you're going to go about this. What we would ask would be that it would be an evidence-based model, so that it actually there would be some study done about the delivery model that would say this works, it works well, and there's evidence to support that it works. And that locally, districts and CBOs and hubs would have to agree on how they're going to go about that. So they would need to convene and make those decisions and then begin the professional development that would allow them to deliver it. And it is a model that has worked well in other places across the nation, and this idea of local choice as long as it's evidence-based.
But there's a problem when you have students that are very mobile, when they may be in a school district that uses one methodology and then they move to an adjacent school district that has a different methodology and so on. How do you deal with problems like that?
Co-Chair Monroe, I honestly am not sure how to fix that exactly when we have a fair level of mobility. I would say that with evidence-based models, it begins to narrow the possibilities quite a bit, and that there will be more similar than dissimilar, I would guess, across the state once this is actually completed.
Okay. Representative Taylor.
I just wanted to follow up on something you said to clarify. So the evidence-based methodologies, is it that school districts will be presented, you have three options for how you can teach early literacy, and then they have to choose one of those, or will there still be this freedom that a teacher could say, you know what, I don't want to do any of those and I'm going to go about it my own way? Or do they have to sign on to a specific methodology?
Co-Chairs Compton Monroe, Representative Taylor. Once the decision is made locally, all educators need to agree that this is what they're going to do in order to receive the resources.
I see. Okay. And then follow up. Then nationwide, you made a reference to working in, you know, this working in other states. Is it that in other states, is there a movement to say we're going to teach this one type of methodology, or is it what you're saying, that each district still is going to come up with something?
Co-Chairs Compton Monroe, Representative Taylor, what I referenced is that when programs have been implemented around evidence-based best practice in a number of different instructional realms, so reading or math or whatever it happens to be, there's been good evidence that, and there's agreement about how that instructional methodology will be implemented, there's good evidence that students make gains And there is that evidence in reading as well. I'm not aware of any state that's done as much as we're talking about doing here, quite frankly. So the
Senator Robel. Oh.
Sorry, just a quick question. I tend to agree with this model because I think it helps all of the kids help each other, and parents, they get lined up. However, it's clear that there are certain learners that certain methods don't work as well as others. And so is there a way in your model to have, for example, they take whole reading, whole language, and they're working with that, and they have some students that clearly the teachers know phonics would work better for them because they need some other structure to their learning. Is there ways in which what's needed by that particular child is going to be introduced in this, supplemental or whatever, to help them get to be a reader?
Co-chairs Compton Monroe, Senator Roland, what you're describing is what I would call a multi-tiered system of support, MTSS, which very education-ese, which would be that we're going to do a part of this process is that there would be a screener for students. So let me describe that. One of the requirements would be that there would be a screener for students when they show up in the K-12 world, where there are lots of different ways to do this. Locally, they would need to make some decision, but hopefully it would be a very quick assessment that would say, here's how well the student reads or doesn't, and this is the issue that's keeping them from being a strong reader, and that would be able to identify, is it vocabulary, letter recognition, phonemic awareness, fluency? There's a whole bunch of different pieces to reading that it identifies very clearly what the student's issue is. And then there is an instructional program that's delivered to that student based on their current system, and that over the course of the year, then you would do some progress monitoring, probably twice over the year, where there would be a quick progress monitoring to see if students are improving on their reading methodology, and you can chart this. And if the student's making good progress, keep going. And if they're not, then you have to ask a question about why not, and is the delivery mechanism not working for this child, and do they need some phonemic building or whatever it happens to be, and that you can identify what the issue is, and that there are, again, evidence-based interventions then that you could deliver to individual students who are struggling. So I know I'm getting, I don't mean to get too into the weeds.
Mr. Wilson?
I want to make sure, do a quick reality check. I know that the deputy superintendent is passionate about this, and it is an important initiative, but we have now spent half the meeting on one slide. I think we will for sure have probably a full day on this initiative, or close to a full day in phase two for the detailed questions. Sorry.
Yes, co-chairs Compton-Monroe. Thank you, Mr. Wilson. If I can spend one more minute on this, I'll move forward at the pleasure of the committee. So that there would be really strong staff development that comes with this, and there's a component of that that really hires up people to be staff developers around literacy in school districts, that there is a summer school program for students who are struggling readers or who need it prior to kindergarten, first, second, and third grade, roughly 30% of students statewide, that there's an after-school support program for struggling readers, which would be 6 hours a week in kindergarten, first, second, and third grade, that there is full day kindergarten, which we're asking for, which is part of this and will make it be a real difference maker, and that we have coordinated instruction and program across districts in a different way than we ever have before. And with that, we can get to 95% of our students being readers by the end of third grade, and it changes downstream costs. It is just a complete difference maker for the state. Thank you. Okay, slide 29, I'm so excited. this is also on the same topic, but I'll move through it quickly. This is really what we found in the Tigard-Tualatin School District, is that when you do a demographic breakout and you've implemented really strong literacy programs, what you see is that students without a enriched program, basically, this is what happens, more or less. I don't have any numbers here, but you can predict on race what percentage of your students are going to be readers by the end of third grade. And it looks pretty much like that, and you're just kind of cruising along. If you implement an evidence-based model, this is what you get. Every student begins to make more, a higher percentage of students begin to be able to be readers by the end of third grade, but you don't close achievement gaps. Honestly, the gap just continues, right? So Asian students go up by 5%, and African-American students go up by 5%. It's a much better model, but you're still not closing the gap. And unless you make it an equity-based program and that you really focus on and you're intentional about trying to close the achievement gap, you don't get this. And this is what you can get when you consider culturally relevant pedagogy, so how you teach, and you involve parent and community in a really different way. And that's part of the reason that this would move resources through community-based organizations. Okay. Slide 30. We are on track with each of our goals, and we track them all with reporting processes. We're not on track with all of them. We track them all with reporting processes. One part of that on how we do that is called, we call a review of our tactics. And on the right of this slide in the really, really tiny print are the tactics that we have around number three, our objective number three, which is an integrated comprehensive system to ensure students graduate for college, ready for college and career. And you can see some of the tactics around this would be establish baseline numbers of students in the Eastern Promise or implementation of the Common Core State Standards and so forth. And there's various components of that, and I'm not going to read through each of those. But again, these are done every 6 months, and you can see that of the 32 tactics that we have, so there are 32 things that we have going on right now in order to deliver on number three. And we measure each one of those 32 every 6 months. And of those, in our last stock take, 24 were done and complete, 7 were very much on track, we were very close to that, and 1 was at risk. And so if you were to look at the stock take on this, on the planning, you would see that it would be green. The planning is good. On the capacity, we would say that it's good, and then we'd have to make some determination about how well we're actually going to deliver. Does that all follow? Okay. So there are 8 slides here where you see the kind of data that we collect to review our progress. I don't plan to crawl through each of them because they can get kind of dense, but I would offer them up collectively as an evidence of our diligence in regard to pursuing outcomes and the work in our strategic plan. So this particular slide shows ninth grade on track data. It's an area where we've adjusted our goal because we are on track to surpass the goal that we had set. And so the 85% target in 2015 used to be 75. It was too low, and so we bumped it up to 85, some of the kinds of adjustment that I talked about. And the ninth grade on track data is a good indicator of future graduation rates. In fact, when we look at the ninth grade on track data for districts, and then we later look at what their four-year cohort graduation rate looks like, they're almost always exactly the same. So if a district has an 82% ninth grade on track rate, they're probably going to have about an 82% graduation rate. It almost is a one-to-one correlation. And so this is a really important indicator for us. 78.5% of our ninth graders last year were on track to graduate, or on track at the end of ninth grade. And we believe that our graduation rate is going to creep up as those students move into high school to about 78.5%. So it's a good indicator. This is a track of our five-year cohort graduation rate. We're above our current target. We had a target of 75.9%, and by this July 1, we intend to meet the target of 77.4%. Our actuals this year were 75.9%, and we think that we'll be, again, above the 77.4% by the end of next year. So this is one where we're accomplishing it. It feels good.
Can I ask a quick short question?
Max? Representative Smith Warner.
So just can you give me the short, how is our 4-year higher than our 5-year? Just kind of normal thinking, you'd think, well, if you'd think 5-year would be higher because if you're counting into 5 years, it would actually be doing better than the 4-year.
Co-chairs Conklin Monroe, Representative Smith Warner. Yes. This data actually shows our ninth grade on track. Ninth grade on track means
that
a student.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Okay, and then this is a 5-year cohort graduation rate. It means that a student graduates within 5 years.
Gotcha.
Now, I believe that our 4-year cohort rate will be 78.5% within 3 years.
So if you think about stacking them, you're probably at what your graduation rate is now, what the 5-year is, what the ninth grade is, and the goal is that as they.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Okay. This tracks our outcome data to close the achievement gap for third grade readers, and you can see that there's a gap and that we haven't closed the gap. If you look at the red is students of color in the state, and you can see that there is a 20-point gap and that there used to be only an 18-point gap. So we're not closing the achievement gap. And that those trend lines virtually more or less mirror each other as going down. And that our goal has been to be much higher than that, and that our goal for 2015 is 59% of students of color reading at grade level. This is why we need a literacy initiative.
Oh.
Senator Roblin.
Just a quick one. You say students of color, does that include all non-white?
It includes all nine, Compton, Senator Roblin, all nine non-white with the exception of Asian.
Okay, because if Asian was in there, I'd be really scared. Thank you.
Slide 34 is new data on our ninth grade on track, which shows students of color are on track about 9 percentage points less than their white counterparts. We've targeted 73% for students of color by this July 1st, and I believe it's a target that we're going to hit. And this is an area where we're actually doing well. This slide shows a nice trend in closing the achievement gap on our five-year cohort graduation rate. We had nearly a 9% gap 3 years ago. We've narrowed that by several percent. Our goal for this year was 68.7%, by this July 1, we've surpassed that with a 2014 rate of 69%. So this is a goal that we're achieving.
Okay.
Senator Roblin.
I just want to ask one more. So far, all of these have shown really appropriate gains, not necessarily whether appropriate or not, but some gain. Is this why the reading one is more likely number one priority? We're actually making progress here, so investment on the other end is probably more important. If we were declining here, I'd have a lot harder time.
Right.
Reshifting money.
Co-chairs Compton Rowe, Senator Roblin, great question. On number three and four, help districts implement effective practice to close gaps, and then also around having students college and career ready, those two. We're much more on track than we are on number two, especially. The reading component is something we just haven't made traction on. We are making some traction on some of the things around increasing our graduation rate and closing achievement gaps for students of color specifically. Still a long ways to go, by the way, and we're not closing that when it comes to third grade reading. Make sure I'm in the right spot here. Data show 61.4% of our students with disabilities were on track for graduation by the end of ninth grade, compared to 78.5% for all students, which is a 17.1 percentage gap. We have set a target of 72% by this July, which is one that we're unlikely to achieve for this year's graduation rate. So not everything, and we've not really moved the dial on our students who are in special education. Make sure I'm on the right number. Here you'll see that we're ahead of target on our five-year cohort graduation rate for special education students. We set a goal of 52.5% or 52.2% for SPED students this July and achieved a five-year grad rate of 56.4% for these students last year. And we've closed the achievement gap on this indicator over the last 3 years by 5.5 percentage points. So this is an area, the graduation rate is an area where we're beginning to see some improvement. And part of this, quite honestly, is due to the fact that we now count students who qualify for a modified diploma, and so that's why it's changed it pretty significantly. Specifically, I don't know that it's really made a difference in, you know, sort of student learning and the percentage of students that would have met otherwise. So these next four slides just show goals 2 through 5, and I know I've been on the strategic plan for a long time, but it is, as I said yesterday, a plan that we work, and this is how we're trying to drive learning outcomes in the state. So I just want you to get them, and I won't spend a lot of time on each of them, but on this particular slide, you'll see that our goal is to have great educators in the state, and it specifically calls for every organization to be led by an effective administrator and every student taught by an effective teacher. And so things like the creation of the more effective statewide evaluation system, that was one of the things we needed to do, and we did that. Or the launch of regional networks designed to support educators becoming more effective in their work is done. Improving educator equity gap and quality instruction around diversification is work that we have underway. And working with OEIB and TSPC to improve effectiveness of our new teachers and license preparation system are things that we have done. You can see the metrics that 100% of teachers and principals are evaluated with the new evaluation system, and at least 30% more educators report increased satisfaction. And so We're measuring where we are with the implementation of the new evaluation system, and we're at very high rates. And we have surveys out that will tell us what students think about, or what teachers think about, the professional support that they're receiving toward that with the TEL survey and others. So we're gathering up that data, and we have gathered it in the past, and we have it tracked in graphs just like I showed you before. But I know that you don't want to see all of those, because we'll be here forever if I did. The number of education professionals projected to enter Oregon's education workforce within 2 years that are non-white and Hispanic, whose native language is not English, increases by 10%. We're on track with that. And that the levels of employer satisfaction with new teachers increases by 30%. And we survey around those things. Goal 3 is about increasing performance of districts and schools in the state. Our objective is to implement the Common Core and the assessment that goes along with it. Support and improve low-performing schools, measure progress on 40-40-20, ensure healthy learning environments for students, and improve federal monitoring processes designed to improve student learning, which is one that's really important to me, that we don't just go out because we get federal money and do the federal checkoff list, but that we use that as an opportunity to actually help while we're there, talk about evidence-based best practices, and support districts in the work that they're doing so that we change student outcomes. And it's, I'm very pleased about the results that we've gotten back from districts about how that's going. And so we have good metrics on these indicators. Goal number 4 is engaging our communities and our schools in our school improvement efforts, which is really about objectives to connect historically underserved communities, provide timely information to stakeholders, and engage more effectively our legislature and other partners across state agencies, which I hope we're having success with. Goal 5 is about improving the department itself and has 4 objectives. Attract talented people to work at the department. Reorganize ourselves so that we are less siloed. Sometimes people like to call them cylinders of excellence, and I think typically it just means you don't do a very good job of coordinating things, and we've broken down silos significantly. Evidence our org chart that I've showed a couple of times. Deliver improved customer assistance and improve in the diversity of our workforce, and we are measuring each of those. This slide, you know, if we weren't pressed for time, I would say let's just spend 15 minutes on this slide, because it's something that I'm incredibly proud of, and it really is, I think, a great indicator about our success on goal number 5, which is to make the Department of Education into a high-functioning place. It just is one of multiple indicators. And I want you to really look at this, because what it will say.
Oh, I didn't mean to interrupt. Representative Taylor and I both serve on the general government sub, and just wondering if you've been working with DAS or how you have been able to move the mark on this so well, especially when you're depending upon, I guess I'm curious what kind of technologies or how have you organized your people in order to move the dial so well?
Co-chairs Compton, members of the committee, we have worked with DAS a little bit, especially around helping us work with a couple different groups. We've worked with a group that's called the Education Delivery Institute, EDI, who came in and worked with us for free for about 6 months, which was awesome, and then we gave them a small contract that helped us think about this and do some of the tracking. DAS helped us with that arrangement a little bit, and we've done a little bit of work with Mass Ingenuity, also through DAS, which has helped us with this. We've kept that fairly small because we don't want to get confusing about who we're working with and how we're attacking this. But really, I credit this to people at the department getting on board with what our mission statement is, and having a plan that is robust, and to know that we're going to measure these things and that we need to deliver, and really being committed to improving instruction and supporting districts across the state. I also very much credit my chief of staff, Sarah Pope, and some of the people who have helped her to say, we're going to do some staff development at the department about customer service. We're going to put up posters at each person's workstation and says, this is what the expectation is around when we return email, how quickly we return our phone calls, and how we're going to communicate with people. And we're going to put stars up on the wall and say, here are the people who are doing great customer assistance in the agency, and these are their names, and people who have told us about what they've done that's great. We just have, you know, had an initiative around this, and we've run right at it. And we had a goal of having 70% on every one of these things. The other thing that we did that I think is really different is we said we're not just going to do this externally. We're going to do an internal customer assistance survey, because one of the biggest problems for us is that if the Office of Finance doesn't quickly get back to the Office of Instruction around a question that has to do with state resources on the state school fund, the person who was asked the question can't answer the district's question. And so if we don't have the same kind of internal customer assistance that we have for our external customers, we can't do our work. It's part of making the department a good place, right, an effective place to work. So we survey these same questions internally, and the results on that are on an upward trend as well. I'd love to tell you that they're all at 79%, but I think we had two at 69% this year, which really chafed me. But the fact that we know it means that we have something to do about it, we can go to work on, and we've done this by every department. So each department, then we break out the data and say, do we have any choke spots within the department where we're not getting this done? And so the fact that 80% on accuracy, and you can go back to 2009 and see it used to be 69%, or 66% in 2009 on availability of information at 77%. And in fact, if you just go back to 2013, you'll see 10% increases in a bunch of these. And it just is having cared about it. So I'll get off of it. But I don't think you're going to see that kind of data very often. I think those numbers will go up again next year, and we're just really pleased that it's happening. Slide 44. Our strategic plan was created in the fall of 2012 and implemented initially in January 2013. It concludes this July, and I wanted you to see the work that we have underway. And I think I said September yesterday, but that by August 2015 we plan to present our 15-17 strategic plan, and that it makes sense for it to tie in with OEIBs and to tie into the two-year funding cycle that we have, especially if we have some initiatives, because we need to be able to tell you here's what's happening in third grade reading. And by February 2017, I need to be able to sit here and say here's what's happening as a result of having implemented third grade reading 6 months ago, and have the data that will show you that, and that it's important for us to track our progress, just as I've probably presented to you ad nauseum this morning. In addition to what we do with the strategic plan that I showed you, we also do internal management reports, audits, review findings from multiple sources, including our internal auditor, Secretary of State audits, and federal audits. And then we also have the legislative key performance measures. Other internal reports, since doing so much of this around timely work, is like efficiency and procurement process for contracts, so we time that stuff. We time how long it takes us to hire someone in HR, because we lose good people if we don't track that, because they get hired by someone else if we take too long to make it through our hiring process. So we regularly send out status reports on all of that, and we do that with IT as well in our IT projects. We're working on being high functioning. The department also has key performance measures, commonly called KPMs. And they're typically adopted during the legislative session. We now have 18 in all, and we're proposing changes to a number of those so that they meet the work and targets of the OEIB and ODE strategic plan. We're proposing 19 of those. This is the list of the topics covered in our 18 current KPMs. You can see they cover anything from access to kindergarten to bus safety or on-time technical projects. And this slide, 47, shows the basics of the list of KPMs that would match the OEIB and ODE strategic plan. They cover kindergarten, early learning, on track to graduate, and support for focus and priority schools, for example, things that are not in our current KPMs but have become very relevant over the last couple of years. And so we're hoping that we can look at those and have those updated sometime over the course of the legislative session. Okay. Slide 48 moves us into department operations, and I'll be shifting the presentation from our strategic plan and all the metrics to performance of educators and students in the state, and with a focus on department operations. So here we have our 13-15 legislatively approved budget, and included $154.2 million all funds, and this is for operations of the department specifically. And you can see the biggest part of our budget was federal funds at 49% and $75.3 million, while our general funds made up $52 million, other funds $24 million, and other non-limited funds at $2.7 million. And the percentages that go along with that, 34% for the $52 million in our general fund. And there is an FTE number here that's 406. Yesterday I had a much higher number. It was 470 some. And this 406 is because Oregon School for the Deaf and the Youth Corrections staff are pulled out of this because this is about central department operations. So 406.2 FTE. Slide 50 is a pie chart that shows little change for the 15-17 career service level budget, which now stands at $160.2 million, and so from 154 to 160, right, just because of the current service level roll-up. The biggest chunk are still federal funds at 45%, second biggest at general funds at 38%, and then other funds and other non-limited funds at 16% and 2% respectively. And 389 FTE, and the reason I keep going over FTE is because I think that it's an interest of yours, and that this is because the limited duration positions are taken out. When the budget of Oregon Department of Education is broken down into the various departments that I'll be talking about as we move forward, it gives you an interesting view of how resources are spent and the volume of work performed by each. The largest component is student services, which is mostly special education, and it's nearly $30 million and 18% of our budget. Early learning is a close second at $27 million and 17% of the budget. Finance office represents $25 million and 16%. Assessment and accountability, $24 million and 15%. Instruction and standards at $23 million and 14%. And then we see a drop off with IT at $15 million and 10% of our budget. Equity at $6 million. Deputy Superintendent, $4 million, Youth Development, $3.8 million, and Research and Data Analysis, our smallest department, at $1.4
million. Mr. Co-Chair.
Yes, Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you. Rob, how many people do you have in your staff of that's 3%? I want to know how many people are helping you out, besides Sarah, which you overwork.
Representative Comp, I don't have that answer at the tip of my fingertips. I know that it is something that I do plan to cover as we move forward in the presentation.
Okay.
I have the exact FTE for each one. Is it 15? I think. I'm going to say 11 and then reserve the right to have my data
change
correct
it later.
Thank
okay,
you.
Thanks.
Yes, thank you. And that includes, we've moved a couple different things into the Deputy Superintendent's office, including the Indian Education Specialist, rationale for that I'll talk about, and then also human resources we moved into the Deputy Superintendent's office. So those are a couple of changes over the last 2 years. And the human resources being moved in is at the suggestion of Mass Ingenuity, which is part of where we've done a lot of work to try to streamline our processes and be more effective with human services, as people are so important to the work that we do. Here we have the 15-17 current service level by expenditure category. So personal services, which are staff, salary, wages, overtime, health benefits, and so forth, is by far the largest category at just over 50% and $81.4 million. Professional services and other services and supplies, which is what the SNS stands for, make up 22%, and state government service charges are 4% at $5.7 million. This graph offers a visual representation of the shifting balance in our budget between general funds, federal funds, and other funds, and other funds, the majority of which are federal. So, for example, for FTE over time, more of our staff have been shifted to do the work of their funding source, which is federal work, because we can't hire people with federal money unless they're doing doing federal work. How they do that work to support the state is a really important nuance and one that we're working hard to make sure that we use effectively. But about half of the staff are supported in part or by whole or in whole by federal dollars. About 15% are supported by other funds, and the rest are supported in whole or in part by the general fund. Just as a rough proxy for this, rough because people are paid different amounts, in 2007-2009 personnel costs were 50% of the general fund and 40% federal funds, with the balance in other. And in 15-17, current service level would have 37% of personnel in the general fund and 63% federal funds, with the balance in other. And you can see that as the state's budget has changed, and there are some things around American Reinvestment Act funds. It's not exactly right, but it's close. You can see that there have been some fluctuation in how this looks, but it gives you an idea that federal funds have become a bigger and bigger part of our budget, as have the expectations that come along with those. This slide provides some detail for two of our departments, the Office of Learning and Early Learning Division, just emphasizing the use of federal funds used for administration, oversight, monitoring, technical assistance, and carrying out other responsibilities as conditions of receiving federal funds, and the percentages retained for grant administration and oversight typically range from 1 to 5%. Some federal funds are used for state-level projects, such as the federal assessment grant for $11 million. So for the state testing that we do, we get $11 million grant every biennium, and the $2 million for the response to intervention special education project, which used a combination of state and federal dollars over the last biennium. The next three slides, 55 through 57, are around the Office of Learning. It's the instruction and standards. Instruction and standards are at the heart of our improvement, support, and monitoring work with district schools and educators. And in the past, this office played a significant role in federal monitoring and includes things like Title I, which is improving outcomes for students who attend high-poverty schools, Title IIA, which is federal professional development funds for staff at districts, and Title III, which is ELL, and Title VI, civil rights. They also support career technical education, charter schools, alternative education programs, state standard setting development, talented and gifted programs, and the physical education grant, all kinds of instructional components in this particular office. Over the past 2 years, some of those responsibilities have grown, or there have been an actual expansion of duties, including the delivery of Senate Bill 290, which is the statewide educator evaluation, its development, and the professional development that goes along with it, support for low-performing schools in our focus and priority work, providing professional development statewide on the implementation of the Common Core standards and other best practice teaching methodology. This department is at the heart of student learning, and it's part of why we keep it in the center of our graph. There are 69 FTE in this division, and they administer over $551 million in federal funds, the vast majority going to districts. These slides cover all of that information. And I didn't go through everything because it takes a little bit too long to do that. Slide 58 through 62 provide information on our assessment department and our assessment system. A point that I feel the need to make is that I remember being a high school principal in 1996, my first year of being high school principal. It was the first time that the state gave an assessment on a statewide basis. The first time in 1996. Everybody took it on a statewide basis. They were required by Oregon Revised Statute, and they were measuring our adopted curriculum standards. Oregon went into statewide testing because the results that we get from statewide testing offer us invaluable information about our system in part. So the system of the state in whole, in part as districts and then schools specifically, and also give some information back about individual students. And to be truthful, I cannot think of a day over the past 3 years, and maybe over the last 19 years since I was a high school principal, that assessment results were not used in a conversation at some point in time during the day. Unfortunately, that may even include my weekend days, because the data that we mine from this is so important to thinking about the work that we need to do and where we are and how we stand and how we're doing against other states, other nations, and the like. And sometimes people call them accountability assessments because they can be used for that. I don't like that. I don't think they should be called accountability assessments. I think they should be called feedback. And they should help us think about what it is that we're trying to accomplish. So we have an assessment department that delivers more than 1 million assessments each year. Assessments in math, English language arts, science, social studies, and the English language proficiency assessment. There are 28 FTE in the division, and they administer assessments totaling $24.5 million in cost. The reason I wanted to talk about when I was a high school principal is because this is something that Oregon chose to do before any federal involvement, because we needed to figure out where we were and how well we were doing and get the feedback mechanism that we needed to improve our instructional program. Then the federal government got really deeply involved, and it's gotten there's a little bit of overkill, right, on assessment, and we need to be careful about it, and we need to push back on the federal government. It's part of the reason that OEIB, and this is really a feather in Nancy's cap and the work that OEIB has done, brought together the group from OEA and ODE and is now bringing together other education partners and created the 12-point suggestion about what we should do with assessment in the state of Oregon and how we ought to alter it so that we make it Oregon's assessment system, not somebody else's assessment system. And we need to push back so that we can get to that place, and I believe that we will, especially with the upcoming reauthorization of the Elementary Secondary Education Act in Washington, D.C.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rob, I agree with everything you said. I just really want to make sure that in Oregon we're focused on the student, like you said early in the presentation, and assessment should be for the sole purpose, not reporting to the feds or how we measure up to other people, but the sole purpose needs to be how we're going to guide Johnny after that assessment to improve. Several of us were on the task force in, I don't know, 08 or so, on the mandatory 10th grade testing. Mm-hmm. Representative Comp and I, at the end of that, I remember talking about maybe we should have had the mandatory 8th grade testing so that we would actually have time to help Johnny, to guide him, because 10th grade, there's not much time left to do much guiding. And so I just wanted to get that on the record. I have no problem with assessments, but they really need to be looking at the individualized need.
Co-chairs Comp and Monroe, Representative Huffman, I couldn't agree more. And if our assessments don't help us with that, you know, it's too much just to look at the health of the system, even though it gives us that. One of the things I like about the fact that we're giving Smarter this year is that for the first time we're going to have an assessment system that some other state gives. We've never had that before, where we're given a test and everybody has it, and then that some other state, Washington and California and Idaho, for example, are all going to give the same assessment that we are. And it will, for the first time, give us an opportunity to really determine what the health of our education system looks like in comparison to other states. We've never had that before. We have the NAEP, we have our graduation rates, and there are real inconsistencies in that. Our NAEP scores are solid as compared to other states. Our graduation rate, not. How are those two things consistent with one another? They don't. That just doesn't make sense to me. And so this will give us an actual no baloney assessment of how it is that we're doing compared to other states when we give this assessment and we get the results back this spring.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Co-Chair Monroe. To be fair in making comments about assessments, because yesterday I asked about the additional cost of Smarter Balance. But is it not true a few years ago that because we were no longer going to be going with the Oaks, that positions were, there were, used to be a lot more positions in that, in this division, and it's my understanding that, yeah, that we have less positions in there, which again is in a sense a cost savings, where now that we're doing Smarter Balance, again, we have consistency in, yeah, there's a couple of things that have transitioned in the last 4 years.
Co-Chair Comp, yes, that's true. There are fewer positions here, and there are two reasons. One is there's just fewer, but the other is also because we broke out a couple of departments.
Mm-hmm.
We used to have our IT and our assessment department tied together, and we needed to not do that anymore, so we broke it out. And it probably makes the number look smaller here, but then there also are a few fewer assessment people. That's correct. If there are, if the numbers of assessment people that are general funded, I'll go with that, because we have been able to secure a couple different grants over time around the development of assessments. One of them is called the ELPA, the English Language Proficiency Assessment. We secured a grant of about, I think it's $10 million for ELPA, to develop ELPA, And it stands for English Language Proficiency Assessment. There is one now, but it's become outdated. And Oregon won the contract to develop that. We're in a consortium with a number of other states, and it will be an assessment that's used by all the states that are in the consortium. And so we have some FTE that are assigned to the development and delivery of that. We're field testing it this spring, and then it goes live next year. So that's an important thing for you to know as well. I want to make sure my comments are accurate about the FTE that are here.
Well, and Senator Monroe.
Go ahead.
Well, and I've been involved or know of the ELPA for about not quite as long as you were, since you've been a high school principal, because, of course, you're older than I am. But Woodburn's been involved for a long time with the test development on the ELPA, and it really has made a big difference in our curriculum design and everything to be a participant in that, forming that assessment. So,
yes, Representative Kopp, yes, and I must be using some of the federal funds to add age, but I'll move on to slide 59.
I know you're younger than I am.
That's not my point at all. But in slide 59, you can see that in Oregon we deliver online computer adaptive assessments. So this is important, because when you deliver a computer adaptive assessment, Oregon was the first to do it, to ever deliver a computer adaptive in this kind of venue, right? And it was approved by the feds. And so when a student takes a test on Smarter Balance this year and used to take it on the Oaks, if they get it right, they get a harder question for the next question. If they get it wrong, they get an easier question.
Yeah.
And we have a big enough assessment bank to be able to do that. And the really important thing about that is, technically, it should make how long you have to sit and take an assessment shorter, because it adapts to more accurately measure what your actual knowledge set is. And the other thing that it does is, instead of saying you fall within this range of acceptable, this assessment can tell if you fall within this learning range, because it's adaptive, it extends out the range of measurement so that we can more accurately say where students at the less knowledge end and the higher knowledge end are, which is really unusual but very important. I'm a little bit disappointed, quite frankly, at how long it takes to take the Smarter Balanced Assessment, because it is computer adaptive. And it is our push and hope that the amount of time that they'll shorten the assessment, and it will take less time in the future, and that actually people in Smarter Balance are very much talking about that, because it is a problem with the assessment, but something that we will get to. In education, the pendulum oftentimes swings from one end to the other, and I feel like we've sort of reached the apex of this summative assessment move. My fear is that we'll swing all the way back,
far back,
and we'll lose some of what's really good about it. Part of the reason we came out with a paper that said here's what good assessment practices look like is because we want to stop that pendulum swing at the appropriate place, make sure that we have the three legs of the assessment stool, formative, summative, and interim, and summative is one of those. And so we need to have it and get it and keep it and have it be right. We have a long history of Oregon being in front of the testing edge, and it's $9.1 million that we got on ELPA, which I needed to call out, and the new ELPA 21, and that assessment corresponds to the Common Core standards, and that's part of the reason that the test needed to be updated. 38 districts are taking the field test in that this spring. And the consortium is 11 other states, and I didn't have that data in front of me when I was talking about it earlier. I said that we administer over 1 million assessments each year, and here's a list of the assessments that we give and the number of students who take them, because students have been able to take some of the assessments more than once, and sometimes as many as three times, we actually administer even more than are listed on this. So you can see that we have 200, almost 300,000 students that take the English Language Arts test, because we give it to every student in grades 3 through 8, and then one time in high school in grade 11, and then math is the same. Social sciences, that's how many students are eligible to take it, but many fewer actually take it. I think that assessment is an assessment that we're required by statute to deliver, but no one is required to take. And so we give that about 15,000 students a year take that, if my memory serves me right. Science is offered just in three grades, and then ELPA The kindergarten assessment and extended assessment is for the 1% of students who really can't take these other assessments and access them so that we can measure how they're doing because they have significant cognitive impairment. And so these would be like really profoundly impacted students cognitively. And so we have a different assessment for that, and it's about 6,000 students. And it's, again, it's about 1% of the students that we have overall. This year we'll administer the Smarter Balance Assessment to students in grades 3 through 8 and 11. About 19 other states are part of the consortia that I referred to earlier that are also given the assessment. We've been one of the lead states in its development. In fact, the CEO of Smarter Balance is Tony Alpert, who formerly worked in the Oregon Department of Education Assessment Office, which I think is rather interesting. It's a better test. It asks for multiple choice, short answer, and some samples that are much longer. It's more expensive to score. There are some test providers that would love for us to have this be computer scored because they really want to develop the algorithm that would allow for that, and there is a lot of work that's being done on that across the nation. There are a lot of problems with that, in my opinion, and we need to make sure that this is scored and scored well so it's human scored. The turnaround time is about 3 weeks, which is pretty amazing for us to get the results back and to begin to look at them as we put them out there. But it is important. It does mean that it's more expensive. I also want to make the point that Smarter Balanced is now housed. It was developed out of a federal grant, but it's now housed at UCLA, the UCLA in California, the college, at a department that they call CREST, which I can't tell you what it stands for, and it has nothing to do with toothpaste. But the point that I want to make here is that it's a nonprofit, and that the Smarter Balanced Assessment Consortia and its delivery and the assessment itself are nonprofit, and that's really important. The other assessment, the PARC assessment, which was also National Consortia, is not. It's a for-profit, and that's an important distinction. It's part of why I'm glad that we chose to go with SMARTER. Besides that, I think it's the best of the assessments.
I noticed that some of the would-be presidential candidates are bashing Common Core pretty regularly as a part of their trying to build political support among their base. Do you have any comments on that?
Yes, Chairman Rowe, I do. Thank you. I think it's really poorly advised to bash Common Core. And in fact, I think if you check in with educators across the state, you'll find that there's broad support for the Common Core standards. Where people have gotten really bent now is then having an assessment that compares to those standards, which you got to have, right?
Yeah.
But the use of the assessment results is really important. Are we going to use the assessment results to evaluate educators? It's part of why we've had a big push and shoving match with the U.S. Department of Education about our evaluation system. Is it appropriate to use those assessment results? There are other ways to measure whether or not educators are getting good student outcomes besides that assessment result. And so that's highly problematic, as is some of the way that summarizing these results are used to characterize schools.
Yeah.
And it has created a lot of pushback. The Common Core itself is a great set of standards. I believe the best set of standards that Oregon has ever adopted, and that most states, I actually think that Massachusetts' old standards were probably better than the Common Core. But nonetheless, Massachusetts has adopted the Common Core. If there were a state that needed to go back to its old standards, it might be them. Don't know if they'd appreciate me saying that, but I bet they won't hear I did. So there is that. I know that Jeb Bush was one of the key proponents of the Common Core standards when they were developed,
yeah.
As was Mike Huckabee.
Yeah.
I have sat in a room a year and a half ago and heard Mike Huckabee say, I fear that we may lose the Common Core standards. This is one of the most important educational developments that we've ever had happen in this nation, and I probably will not be president because I refuse to walk away from them. And so It is a weird,
maybe other reasons.
It is a really strange event that has taken place, and there's all kinds of conspiracy about where this came from, what it is, and how it, and so on and so forth. To some degree, I really don't care. Is it a good set of standards, and does it target a high enough set to make sure that students are going to be ready to be successful once they graduate from high school? Yes, that's what I care about.
I just really troubled when it gets politicized to the degree that appears to be happening. I guess we'll just have to do what's best. We're out of time. Representative Taylor?
I just have one quick question, please, Chair. Are there school districts in the state that are doing the interim formative and summative assessments? Some districts are doing it and some are not doing all three?
Co-Chairs Kaufman Rowe, Representative Taylor, I would say that all districts are doing all three.
Okay.
The question is sort of how well and with what support around staff development. So there are some districts that have really nicely refined measures that help change student outcomes. A formative assessment happens every day in every classroom. It's a check for learning that teachers do, and then they alter their instruction. Interim is more like a quiz or a unit test. There's a lot of work that we could do to support teachers to deliver those really well and to have a nice bank to choose from. And we actually have created some banks of questions, and we're building that even now. Mm-hmm. We're working with UCLA Crest to develop a separate bank, as well as U of O and Stanford. So we've got a couple different banks of these that we're putting together. But more professional development support really is needed.
Mm-hmm. Senator Roblin.
Yeah, and I really like, and I agree with you. I've talked to a lot of educators who think Common Core is really the way we need to be going. I hope that we develop a system over time like we did with our old writing assessments, where we really make a part of understanding that with the children themselves, so they know the standards, so they understand what it is that they're expecting. Because I know that for my youngest daughter, who really loved assessment, she at the end of her 11th grade, when she did her writing assessment, she didn't really care what the assessor gave her, because she already knew, and she complained that the assessors didn't understand their system as well as she did, because she could explain to them why they got it wrong. And I felt that was really kind of neat to see that we had actually helped the students themselves understand the standard they should be writing to. And the fact that she could identify what she'd done, and when they said this part was wrong, she said, they missed it. Here's why that's right. And I thought, if we can get that in math and if we can get that in literacy so that the kids really know what it is that we're trying to get them to do, then these tests will be inconsequential. They'll be important to see where we're going, but our kids will assess themselves when they're taking the test if they didn't get a standard. That would be really nice.
Agreed. And Mr. Wilson, tomorrow continuing?
Continuing again with the presentation by the agency, public testimony. It will be scheduled for Tuesday and, if necessarily, on Wednesday of next week on both the state school fund bill and the department's budget bill. So keep that in mind, and the usual constraints or rules will apply. Those that have traveled the farthest will be given first priority or at least made sure they have time during the day. Plus, we may be in another room for that. We may need a larger room for public testimony.
Okay. But Mr. Saxon will have tomorrow and Monday for continuing his presentation.
He's only got it
for the next 150 slides.
We're moving.
Thank you very much. We're adjourned. You.